Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world. From border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in today to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology, always looking for processes and attributes that can bring efficiency to healthcare. I'm really pleased my guest today is Patty Padmanabhan. Patty is the founder and CEO of Damo Consulting. He's an extremely prolific author on digital healthcare and also host of his own podcast show, The Big Unlock. We'll talk more details about that in a few minutes. His most recent book is titled Healthcare Digital Transformation. Patty, welcome to the show today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. Great to be here.
Let's just jump right in it. And the shift to digital health and virtual models of care have really accelerated so much in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Normally, what would have taken years of adoption and rollout were really compressed into weeks. And so this adoption and use specifically of telehealth technology, is this permanent or will it decline as the COVID-19 pandemic recedes? What are your thoughts on that, Patty?
Great question. And I asked the same question to guests on my podcast, and I asked this question to other technology executives in healthcare and chief digital officers. I was speaking to someone this morning, and I was asking this question. He is the chief digital officer of a large health system in the Southeast. And he said that over the longer term, they expect about 20% of all ambulatory visits to shift to some kind of a virtual care model. Today, we know that prior to the pandemic, we had a very low level of virtual care visits. It was growing, but it was growing slowly. The pandemic, of course, put it over the top because there were no options. You had to go virtual or you lost the ability to take care of your patients. Now, we swung to one extreme in the immediate wake of the pandemic. All indications are that now there is some degree of pullback because you cannot take care of your patients through virtual care models for every kind of care need and indefinitely. So we are seeing a shift back towards in-person visits, but there is going to be a permanent and lasting shift towards virtual care models. And that number is going to vary from health system to health system. I have heard estimates that as much as 80% of all ambulatory care could be candidates for some kind of a virtual care model. But, you know, nobody knows where the equilibrium is going to be. We're still in the middle of all this. It is safe to say that there's going to be a significant shift towards virtual care.
You know, that is one thing where this adoption of telehealth as a means for healthcare delivery really was not invited into healthcare systems and practices. It really was demanded. And so many of these healthcare entities that had never done it had to adopt some type of software platform and figure out one way or another some lessons learned or best practices and actually start doing it. So that initial hump, I think, you know, over people know how to do it somewhat. But part of the underlying issue, of course, is reimbursement. Now, I believe, and maybe you can give us some details, that CMS certainly elevated some of the reimbursement for telehealth to become parity with face-to-face, but that may be rolled back. What are your thoughts on that, Patty?
You know, I'll preface my response with a caveat that I'm not as close to policymaking as some of the others who come on your show. But everything that I know and I hear and I read points to the fact that there is a great desire on the part of the administrators and the policymakers to make the current waivers permanent. There is some unfinished business. From what I know, telehealth visits are not being reimbursed at a rate that adequately compensate for all of the fixed costs of in-person care. And so there's got to be some degree of rationalization, if you will, between in-person visits and an equivalent televisit. And again, there's a whole range of telehealth modalities, you know, from everything from text, SMS, to audio to video, and they're all different. And so there is some amount of rationalization. And my understanding is that this, despite the desire, there is some degree of congressional activity that is required to make it all permanent. We are hopeful. I think that is a short answer. And I think the industry is operating on the assumption that the current waivers in place for telehealth are going to remain and possibly even get expanded. We won't know till it actually happens, but I think that is the operating assumption right now.
Yeah, I would agree. That's similar to everything that I've heard, Patty. This sudden adoption of virtual healthcare delivery, I'm sure there were many challenges for providers and healthcare entities. Could you speak a little bit maybe about some of the best practices that have arisen and or lessons that have been learned for those who've had to do these sudden adoptions?
Yeah, there's plenty of those out there. I think there's a whole spectrum of health systems that that represent the kind of experiences that everyone had to go through in the wake of the pandemic. So at one extreme, you had health systems that were already well along in their telehealth programs, and for them it was a matter of scaling rapidly and being able to take on increased volumes of telehealth visits in the immediate wake of the pandemic. And so they already had the programs in place. Their caregivers were trained. They had their processes in place. What they probably had to do was to scale it all up and make sure that they could deal with like a 5x or a 10x increase in virtual visits and make sure they had all the equipment that they needed to handle these visits. And it can be very simple things. You know, if you don't have a computer monitor that has a webcam on it, you got to go out and get the webcam, right? And what if everybody's trying to buy the same webcam and your local Best Buy is out of stock? Where do you go? So very, very tactical things like that people had to overcome. At the other extreme, I was talking to somebody last week where they had practically no telehealth visits in their overall care model. They had a telehealth platform, but it was not being used for a variety of reasons. And then all of a sudden, the pandemic comes along, and they went from zero to 100,000 visits in a three-month time frame. That obviously put an enormous amount of pressure and strain on the resources within the system. It put pressure and strain on caregivers. It put pressure on the patients, of course. Now, the good news seems to be that everyone, by and large, has come through and has figured it out and has managed to take care of their patients. We worked with one health system in New York City, which basically stood up a telehealth platform over a weekend. Mm. So that's an extreme example, but those are not uncommon. I mean, we have, if you go around the country, you will find that several health systems went through the same experience. Good news, I think, is that as someone said to me, never waste a crisis, and the crisis has really given us the focus that was required to take telehealth seriously, go about adopting it at an enterprise level and make it an integral part of your care delivery model. And I think most health systems are now in a place where they just have to make sure that it's optimized, it's all integrated, your telehealth platforms are integrated with the backend systems, and you're able to capture all the encountered data for billing and care and so on. I think the one thing that you asked about, what are some of the best practices? The one thing that I hear consistently over and over again is don't start with the technology. Start with the needs, start with the process, start with the stakeholders and how they want this to work. And then you can back into the technology. The technology is almost easy. Someone said to me once is that when you talk about a digital health or even a technology transformation program, it's 80% people, 15% process, and 5% technology. So that gives you a sense of what the priorities should be when you roll out something like this.
Many of these healthcare systems are dependent on workflows and processes that have taken months and years to streamline. How referrals are handled, how refill medication requests are handled, all those kind of things. And almost out of the blue, there was a need to develop these workflows. What are the appropriate telehealth encounters? How do you educate, the patients? I mean, just the things that whether it's the provider or the patient, they should be in a quiet area with a good broadband. There should be good lighting, just things like mm-hmm. that. And in my own experience as a patient using telehealth, there's certainly different formats. Some you have to download an app and configure it out. Some you just click on the link and you're in the encounter. So there's so many different ways that everybody had to get educated, but I'm sure it was really bumpy while those things were being worked out those first few weeks.
Right.
One thing that has happened is healthcare was forced to do with digital telehealth technologies. It was just, you could not ignore it. If you wanted to keep delivering healthcare and receive reimbursement, you had to do it. There was just no real choice around it. And so, the adoption of EHRs took years, years, and years. Here, it was literally in a few weeks. But we're over that hump. So one thing I'm kind of curious your thoughts about, Patty, is does that make providers and organizations less scared of other digital virtual care models like remote patient monitoring, which has fantastic opportunities for healthcare? Is it going to be easier for that to be expanded?
You know, remote patient monitoring has been around for a while. It's been mostly practiced in the context of population health management for chronic diseases in particular. And so there have actually been businesses that have been built around addressing chronic disease populations using remote care models, using smart devices, wearables, harvesting the data that comes off of these devices in order to run advanced analytics algorithms and stratify the populations in terms of their risk and intervening in appropriate and timely ways in order to make sure that the populations remain healthy. And this is a business model that a number of the emerging or more recently formed telehealth companies, digital health companies, like Livongo, for instance, have really built a business around. Now, many of them have actually gone out and built a business model by targeting payers and employers to mm-hmm. begin with, because they're the ones that are more incented and motivated to keep patients outside the hospital, and they didn't have to deal with fee for service and all that. They just wanted to keep the patients. They just want to keep the cost low. So these programs have worked very well for them. But it's the progress of these kinds of remote monitoring models has been slower with health systems. I think part of it has to do with the reimbursement environment. And if you don't get reimbursed adequately, then there isn't an incentive for you to go out and invest in the technology and the infrastructure that you need to invest in so that you can get the benefits. So the progress has been a little bit slow relative to, let's say, self-insured employers or health plans. But I think that is going to change in the wake of the pandemic right now, because not only are you now looking at chronic disease populations, but you're also looking at routine care needs that are going to be addressed through remote care models, simply because the foot traffic in the hospitals is not going to come back to pre-pandemic levels anytime soon. So you have to find a way to take care of your populations in their homes, and in fact, take care into the homes. And so I think these technologies are going to now see some degree of resurgence, if you will, in interest and demand. It remains to be seen. It's all very early days. We're still in the middle of the pandemic.
It really is. And with remote patient monitoring, it's one of those cases where the technology is there, and the different entities, insurance, hospitals, ambulatory practices, the return on investment varies so much. I imagine that hospitals, when they diagnose somebody, who are discharged with that diagnosis of whether it's hypertension or congestive heart failure or something like that, they want to make sure that patient does not get readmitted with that diagnosis within 30 days, or it costs them money. The case of a ambulatory practice, to monitor those patients that they are the caregiver for, I think the Medicare, I'm not exactly positive on my numbers, but Medicare, there's a setup fee for the devices, and then I think Medicare will pay reimburse about $140 a month. Medicaid varies from state to state. Some states allow the durable medical equipment companies to bill. Medicare does not. So it's a mixed bag on the reimbursement side of things. To my mind, it's very clear it's good healthcare delivery to monitor those patients at home.
Yeah, and I will point out one thing that I think there is a recognition at the policymaking levels with the administration that this is important. And I point to one thing, which is, you know, the recent FCC telehealth grant program. They handed out $200 million or so, and the average size of the grant was somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. And my firm has studied all the grants, and majority of these grants are for programs that have some kind of a remote monitoring component to it. Right? So you're serving underserved populations, maybe in inner cities, maybe in rural areas, but you're doing that with smart devices and through telehealth models, and the grants are actually providing funding to buy these devices and give it to these underserved and vulnerable populations so that, you know, they can ride this out. And at the same time, you now have a vast body of work that will inform future policy decisions in terms of the effectiveness of these programs. I think it's a great move. And you are going to see more of that as the health systems start to adopt these programs and kind of roll them out at a larger level. We're still in, again, like I said, somewhat in early stages, but the technology, to your point, is definitely there. Again, the technology from the devices standpoint has been there for a long time, but now to combine it all into a platform where you not just look at the devices, but you take the data from the devices, you have software that aggregates all of the data and can present it to you in a way that you can analyze, you know, it's standardized and normalized, and then you run advanced analytics algorithms on it in order to risk stratify the population, intervene, and demonstrate results for chronic population like diabetes, hypertension, and so on. I think that is really where we are headed. You cannot look at it in isolation, in bits and pieces. You have to look at it holistically.
You know, that's so true. And in the case of someone with congestive heart failure, you get them to step on a digital scale, hooked up with a SIM card or some other way once a day, and it transmits to a software foundation that has an algorithm that's adjustable. It says if they gain 3 pounds in a day or 4 pounds in 2 days or whatever, immediately, do a flag on a dashboard of whoever's monitoring those patients.
Yeah.
So it's not as hard as going to the moon, you know. And once, it is a type of thing that most practices have not started doing, but I'm hoping the telehealth experience will and with proper reimbursement kind of open up that kind of care. You know, one of the things that is a core element of digital transformation healthcare is the concept of healthcare data interoperability. Everybody has different definitions of that, but we know it when we see it. Having the right information on the right patient at the right time. And this is if not a multi-year, possibly even a multi-decade trajectory. Where are we in that whole trajectory? Where are we now, and how close are we to the pot of gold that we're looking forward to?
Right. I think it's unfortunate that when we mandated the implementation of electronic health records, mandated maybe is not the word because it was incentive. We failed to put in the safeguards to make sure the data is interoperable and it moves freely from system to system. So we are now playing catch up. The good news is that we have the electronic health record backbone. We have near 100% penetration of EHR systems across the country at every level healthcare facility. Now we just have to make sure that the data is interoperable. Technically, it is interoperable. So if someone wants to share information, technically, they can share information. What has happened is that because of a variety of commercial incentives or disincentives, the desire and the effectiveness of transferring the data has been somewhat limited. And this is not just about technology firms. This is also about healthcare providers who don't necessarily want to share the data for a variety of business reasons and business interests. Now, I think eventually, in the last few years, the noise has become the decibel levels have risen steadily. And so we are seeing that this interoperability question, which was on everybody's minds about 2-3 years ago, it's fading a little bit into the background because people are figuring out that, yeah, it is not all that hard and there is a little bit more cooperation between technology firms and a little bit more enablement by the providers. And it's coming along nicely, but it's still not at a place where the patient, who should be and is at the heart of this entire experience, doesn't have access to data as easily as he or she needs it. And you know it and I know it. And that is why I think the CMS has stepped in. We have the 21st Century Cures Act, and we've got all these interoperability final ruling deadlines, which have been pushed out to 2021, but they are out there. And as and when they go into effect, we're going to see a couple of things. Information blocking is going to become a serious offense, and we are going to see patients getting access to their medical records with a push of a button, and they can transfer it to anyone they like, and they take responsibility for their actions, in terms of obtaining the data and sharing it with other applications or other developers or other, entities, as the case may be. So I think we're going in the right direction. It is still unfinished business, but I think we've come a long way. I certainly see that the noise levels have come down. And when I talk to my clients with whom we're doing work around this, they're less concerned about challenges with technology firms or for the technical issues of moving the data. They are now focused on making sure that they're compliant with the final ruling as and when it goes into effect, as more so in the case of payers. Not that serious an issue with the providers, because for the most part, the providers are relying on technology firms who are going to be compliant anyway. So it's a fairly complicated topic here, but that's kind of my sense, if I were to summarize it.
I'd be curious to know, at Demo Consulting, your consulting entity, who are your clients? Are they health system, insurance companies, ambulatory, large practices? Who are you providing your consulting on digital transformation of healthcare? Who do you work with?
Most of our clients are large integrated health systems or health systems. It could be academic medical centers, it could be large hospitals, it could be integrated health systems. These are our clients. And, they're typically multi-billion dollars in revenue. They have clearly identified budgets for multi-year digital transformation programs, and they're committing themselves to developing roadmaps and implementing them, and committing themselves to making big technology choices as well as organizational decisions related to completely transforming their organizations, both at the front and the back end. That's typically the profile of the clients that we work with.
And when you're talking about the front end, you talk about the actual clinical interface with patients?
Yeah, I'm talking about patient access and patient experiences. And so these would be, one way of identifying them would be to say these are digital front door programs. But it's not just digital front doors, because digital front doors typically means you're talking about access. Yeah. Access is the number one priority today, by the way, for all health systems, especially in the light of COVID. You want to make sure that patients have the tools to be able to come online, to find, to triage themselves, to find the service that they need, find a provider of their choice, schedule an appointment, and do the visit all online. And so this is a very high priority for health system. This is a big part of the work that we do. But, we talked about remote monitoring. That is another big aspect of the work that we do, because those models are now becoming more and more important for health systems. And last but not least, the technology infrastructure that needs to transform in order to support the digital experiences of the future. So whether it is data and analytics infrastructure, whether it's the API management infrastructure to expose all of the data through FHIR APIs for developers and for enabling the experience in the front end, is cloud migration strategies, is a whole range of things, is infrastructure upgrades, is a whole range of things that a health system has to invest in order to prepare to be a predominantly digitally enabled enterprise in the future. So that's kind of the range of what we work with, but that's also the difference between the front and the back. And the front end is typically to do with the patient experiences and access to care.
We're almost totally out of time, but before we run out, Patty, how can listeners reach out to you to learn more about Damo Consulting and the work you're doing, and just find out more about?
Thank you for that. Yeah, you can. I would invite them to go to damoconsulting.net. That's damoconsulting.net, or go to my personal website, which is thebigunlock.com. Which is really my professional website. All the work that I do, my publications and writings, my speaking engagements, and a whole lot, the podcast, all of that information is there. On my company's website, you can see a lot of thought leadership content, research, and so on. Most of it is complimentary. You can download it. Google me, and you'll find all the links.
And your podcast is at thebigunlock.com. Is that where we can find that? Okay, great.
That is correct. TheBigUnlock.com. You'll get it anywhere you get your podcasts.
Okay. Yeah. Well, to our audience, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest today, Patty Padmanabhan. Patty, thanks for coming aboard today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, Jim.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.